Many people book cruises on the Mediterranean Sea, and for good reason. It's beautiful. The cities along the coast are fascinating and historically significant, and the cruise ships themselves are luxurious. In Acts 27, Paul set sail on the Mediterranean heading towards Rome, but it's nothing like a modern-day cruise. His traveling companions are prisoners, and his vessel's anything but a luxury liner. Worse, this group is about to be tossed into a violent, life-threatening storm without the benefit of life vests or seasickness pills. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie, the true story, The Perfect Storm, where this group of fishermen go out on a boat to go fishing and off the New England coast and find themselves in the middle of a nor'easter slash hurricane. They fight the wind and the waves that are as tall as buildings, and trying to keep that small boat afloat for over 3 days. It's a harrowing experience to watch as they fight for their very lives. And in the end, they all end up perishing. And as crazy as that true story is, Paul and his boatmates find themselves in a very similar situation in our passage today. Their very lives will hang in the balance as God's promise that the gospel will make its way to Rome via Paul hangs in the balance as well. Let's read and see what happens in this incredible passage in the book of Acts. Acts chapter 27, we're going to start with verses 1 through 5. And when it was decided that we should sail for Italy, they delivered Paul and some of the other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius, and embarking in a ship of the Adramidium, which was about to sail to the ports along the coast of Asia, we put to sea, accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica. The next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go to his friends and be cared for. And putting out to sea from there, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus, because the winds were against us. And when we had sailed across the open sea, along the coast of Sicilia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra and Lycia. Here we see in verses 1 through 5, all aboard. All aboard. The account begins with the word we. The author of the book of Acts is on a ship. He was on the ship with Paul, Dr. Luke. And Dr. Luke proves himself to be an intelligent, diligent, and accurate historian. He reports as an eyewitness about all the stops that they make, the nature of the ships that they're sailing on, the sailing practices that those on board use, and the sailors' experience. We can trust that this account of Paul's ordeal is accurate and real. Also on the boat is a centurion, Julius, who will display generosity and kindness in his leadership throughout the trip. Also on the ship is Aristarchus. Aristarchus is mentioned by Paul in the book of Colossians. He was a fellow traveler with Paul on many of his missionary journeys. The Romans probably viewed him as Paul's servant, but to Paul, he was his fellow co-worker and missionary. The ship, called the Adramidium, sails north 70 miles to Sidon, where it makes its first port. Julius kindly gives Paul permission to enjoy the fellowship of friends. At this point, Paul has friends on every major city across the Mediterranean, and Julius clearly does not see Paul as dangerous, so Paul's ministered to by his friends. Christian friendship is an important theme throughout the book of Acts. Luke will often refer to Christians as friends and use the words interchangeably. In 3 John, verse 15, John does the exact same thing. Listen to this verse. Peace to you. The friends send you greeting. Greet the friends by name. Christian friendship is a gift of God that is rooted in our relationship with Jesus. We can thank God for Christian friends. Well, then they set sail again, making port in Myra. It says that they sailed under the lee of Cyprus. You ever wonder what that means? The lee? Well, that means that they sailed behind the island of Cyprus to protect themselves from the winds. So when you sail in a lee of an island. You're sailing behind it so you can take advantage of its protected waters. Let's keep reading. Verse 6 through 12. There, the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing for Italy and put us on board. We sailed slowly for a number of days and arrived with difficulty at Cnidus. And as the wind did not allow us to go further, we sailed under the lee of Crete, off Salmone. Coasting along with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Haven, near which was the city of Lycia. Since much time had passed and the voyage was now dangerous because even the fast was already over, Paul advised them, saying, "Sirs, I perceive that this voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only the cargo of the ship, but also our lives." But the centurion paid more attention to the pilot and the owner of the ship than to what Paul said. And because the harbor was not suitable to spend the winter in, the majority decided to put out from the sea from there, and on chance that somehow they would reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, facing both southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. Here we see all change. All change. In Myra, Julius finds a seaworthy ship to sail to Italy that they can take on the open waters. This is a big vessel. We learn later that it holds up to 300 people. In verse 7 to 8, the conditions of the seas worsen. And here we start getting the first glimpses of how dangerous actually sea travel was. Maybe you haven't been paying attention to the news lately, but the Mediterranean Sea is a pretty rough body of water. Here lately, the Army Corps of Engineers and the military and all their best minds have been trying to tame it by building a pier off of Gaza so they can take relief supplies into the poor people in Gaza. But it has been thwarted by bad weather, bad currents, waves that have been bashing that floating dock. And over a two-month period, only 7 days has it been operational. As a matter of fact, it has been taken down now, and there's no plans to put it back up. The Mediterranean Sea has basically beaten the military, the United States military, and the Army Corps of Engineers. This is a rough body of water, and we see that here in these passages. They make port in Fairhaven, which sounds like a nice place, but it's not suitable for the winter weather or the currents. Verse 9 says the fast was already over, or what we know is the Day of Atonement. They would fast during the Day of Atonement, so they would call it the Day of the Fast. This was observed in late September or early October. The time between September and November were particularly dangerous for sea travel. In fact, sea travel practically ceased between November and mid-March because it was so dangerous. Paul knows this, and he tries to warn Julius if they continue, they'll lose the ship and lose the lives of the people on board. Now, this is Paul's own advice. It's not prophecy, because we'll see that no men will be lost. But the ship will not be as fortunate. Julius does not listen to Paul, but listens to the captain instead, which would have been a natural decision. If you and I were on a boat, would you rather listen to some political, religious leader? Or would you listen to the captain of a vessel that's been out on the boat for his whole life? So that's what Julius does. But next time, Julius will listen to Paul, because Paul's right. Let's keep reading. Verses 13 through 20. Now when the south wind blew gently, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, they weighed anchor and sailed along Crete close to the shore. But soon a tempestuous wind, called a nor'easter, struck down from the land. And when the ship was caught and could not face the wind, they gave way to it and were driven along. Running under the lee of a small island called Calda, we managed with difficulty to secure the ship's boat. After hoisting it up, they used supports to undergird the ship. Then, fearing that they would run aground on the Cytrus, they lowered the gear, and thus they were driven along. Since they were violently storm-tossed, they began the next day to jettison the cargo. And on the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest lay upon us, all hope of us being saved was at last abandoned. Here we see all over. All over. When they get south of the island of Crete, sure enough, they encounter a huge storm. The sailors fear for their lives. Listen to all that they did trying to save themselves. In verse 17, they pulled up the ship's lifeboat, used to take people from the ship to land. It probably trolled behind the ship, but they pulled it up onto the deck. Then they undergirded the ship by taking cables and strapping them around the bottom of the ship to reinforce it. Then they dropped gear, probably an anchor, in an attempt to slow the ship so it wouldn't drift into the rocky shores of Sirtis that was known as the ship graveyard. In verse 18, they threw the cargo overboard to make the ship lighter. You know, if you are throwing your cargo overboard, you are desperate. The whole reason you're on the seas in the first place is to get paid to take cargo from one place to another. If you throw the cargo overboard, you're not getting paid. In verse 19, they throw over the tackle, which was probably the ship's main beam supporting the main sail. How they would navigate, how they would move across the water. They're so desperate, they throw the main sail overboard. They were desperate. They couldn't see the sun or the stars or their only form of navigation. The men were left with no cargo, which meant no money, no gear, so they couldn't even steer the ship, no stars, no navigation, no hope. And that, when the crew has no hope, God speaks. Listen to what he says, verse 21 through 26. Since they had been without food for a long time, Paul stood up amongst them and said, "Men, you should have listened to me and not have set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. Yet now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night there stood before me an angel of God to whom I belong and whom I worship. And he said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you and all those who sail with you. So take heart, men, for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I have been told. We must run aground on some island.'" Here we see that all listen. Paul is here probably with two other Christians on a ship full of close to 300 soldiers, prisoners, and crewmates. And Paul stands up and shines the light of Jesus Christ. The first words of Paul's are words of encouragement rooted in the word of the Lord. His word seems to at first to be an "I told you" speech, but he's really proclaiming his credibility. He tells them good news, that no one will die, but then the bad news, the ship will be lost. He tells them an angel came to him in the night telling him Paul must appear before Caesar. All aboard, the ship will survive and there's no need to fear. We all face storms in life. We're all prone to fear when the winds blow and the waves beat against us. But take heart. The message given to Paul is the same message that Jesus gave the disciples in the storm as well. Do not be afraid. It's the same message that Isaiah gave the Israelites in their time of despair. Isaiah 43, 1 through 2. "But now thus says the Lord, he who created you, O Jacob, he who formed you, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by name. You are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned. The flame shall not consume you." The same message that Jesus gave the disciples in the upper room. The same message that Isaiah gave the Israelites in their despair. The same message that Paul gave his shipmates is the same message that God wants to deliver to you. Do not be afraid. So now they're without sail, still being driven by winds, and the crew gets desperate. You'd be desperate too if you'd been beaten for 14 days and nights by storms on a rough ocean. Let's read about their last desperate attempt for some of these men to save themselves. Verse 27 through 32. "When the 14th night had come, as we were being driven across the Adriatic Sea, about midnight the sailors suspected that they were nearing land. So they took a sounding and found 20 fathoms. A little further on they took a sounding again and found 15 fathoms. and for fearing that we might run on the rocks, they let down 4 anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship, and had lowered the ship's boat into the sea under the pretense of laying out anchors from the bow, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, "Unless these men stay in the ship, you can't be saved." Then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it go. Here we see that all stay. All stay. After taking depth findings, they realize they're approaching shore and that the rocks would dash their boat apart. They lay out 4 anchors to keep them from moving closer to the rocks. And part of the crew hatched a plan to escape the ship. They say that they would take the lifeboat and act like they were going to attach more anchors off the bow of the ship. But then they would take off for land in the lifeboat, leaving everybody else behind stranded. Paul hears of the plan and reports it to Julius. He tells Julius, as everyone's to survive, everyone has to stay on the ship. Julius this time listens to Paul, and they cut the boat loose before it can be taken by those wishing to flee. It's clear now that Paul's being listened to, and he's being respected by those on the boat. He's not only respected, but we'll see that he's become in charge of the ship. Let's look at verses 33 through 38. As the day was about to dawn, Paul urged them all to take some food, saying, "Today is the 14th day that you've continued in suspense without food, having taken nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take some food, for it will give you strength, for not a hair is to perish on the head of any of you." And when he had said these things, he took bread, and giving thanks to God in the presence of all, he broke it and began to eat. Then they all were encouraged and ate food themselves. We were all 276 persons in the ship. And when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship, throwing out the wheat into the sea. Here we see all eat. It seems that the experience has been so harrowing that over 14 days, no one's taken time to really eat. If you've ever been in a crisis situation, you know that one loses their appetite, and many times you have to be reminded to eat, and even when you're told to eat, you don't have an appetite. Now imagine your crisis is happening on open seas with rolling waves and billowing swells 24/7. Paul knows if they're going to have enough strength to reach land, they must eat. See, Paul reminds them that God told them that not a hair on their head would be injured. And they'd have to trust him, and they need to eat. I don't know about you, but the wording here and the description given almost sounds like Jesus in the upper room with the disciples, where Jesus broke the bread, blessed it, and passed it out to his disciples to eat. Right before a very harrowing time where they didn't even know it, but their very lives were on the line. Now, I don't think that this meal on the ship was very religious, except for Paul's involvement, but you can't dismiss the resemblance of what Paul is doing to what Jesus did in the upper room. The men are encouraged. And so they lighten the ship even more. They throw all the food overboard, trusting in what Paul said is true. But the question's still out there. Will they survive? They have no food, now no mainsail, no lifeboat, and still the winds and waves continue to beat. Will they survive? Will their trust in this Paul and his God, Jesus Christ, this God of Abraham, will he save them? Well, let's read and find out. Verses 39 through 44. And when it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they noticed a bay with a beach, on which they planned, if possible, to run the ship ashore. So they cast off the anchors and let them in the sea, and at the same time loosening the ropes that had tied the rudders. Then hoisting the foresail to the wind, they made for the beach. But striking a reef, they ran the vessel aground. The bow struck and remained immovable, and the stern was being broken up by the surf. Soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any should swim away and escape. But the centurion, wishing to save Paul, kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and make for the land, and the rest on planks or on pieces of the ship. And so it was that all were brought safely to land. Here we see all survive. As the sun appears on the horizon, they see the land and they see a place to run the ship ashore. They pull up the anchors, they put up the smaller foresail, and they head for the beach. The ship strikes a sandbar. They can't get it loose, and the waves proceed to batter the ship to pieces, sending all passengers, all 276 souls, into the ocean. Now, Julius has an interesting dilemma. Normal practice in a shipwreck of prisoners is a command to kill all the prisoners, so no prisoners have a chance of escaping. And that's what Julius normally would have done. Actually, his very life is on the line. If he allows one prisoner to escape, his own life is on the line. But now, he is respected and probably admires Paul and this God of which he speaks. So he doesn't want Paul killed. So he halts the orders of the soldiers. He told everyone who could swim to jump in, and those who could not swim to grab a piece of wood or wreckage and to float to shore. The account tells us that every single person was saved. Not one soul perished. All survived. Once again, God's word proves itself true. Now, what can we take from this passage, this incredible passage, and Paul's example? Well, here's what we are to do. Number one, live your faith in the midst of a crisis. Paul lives out his faith in the midst of his crisis. While we don't see aggressive evangelism taking place in this voyage, we do see Paul taking every opportunity to point people to God. He spoke of his God in verse 23 before speaking God's promise, and later when he blesses the food for the whole ship. Paul spoke and prayed in the midst of hopelessness, giving the crew an alternate perspective, a ray of hope, and something more important to ponder. Is there one who holds the universe in the palm of his hand? Is there one who holds the seas and the wind and the rain in the palm of his hands? And is that person the God of Abraham and Moses and of Paul? We too should look for the opportunities to point people to Christ in our everyday lives. For we all go through crises, we all go through issues, and people are asking the same question. Is it true? Is the God of Abraham true? Does he really exist? Does he really care? Does he really hold us in the palm of our hands? And my friends, as we go through crises, as we go through life with them, we can point them as well to the God of Abraham, the God of Paul. Second, trust in the promises of God. Know that God keeps his word. God told Paul he would reach Rome. He did. God told Paul none of the sailors would be lost. They weren't. God told Paul the ship would run aground. It did. God would accomplish his purposes, and we should obey him and trust him. God is at work in your life. Though you may not understand everything that's going on, know that God is working all things for his good and for his glory, and we can trust him. William Cowper wrote the words of his hymn, God Moves in a Mysterious Way, and this is what he wrote. God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. Finally, rejoice in the saving grace of God. God saved those men and Paul for the express purpose that the gospel would go from Judea to Rome. It took a lot for Paul to get to Rome. Just as it took a lot for the gospel to get to Rome, it took a lot for the gospel to get to you. Marvel at God's grace that he would save 276 heathens out on the sea. And marvel at God's great grace that he took the gospel 2,000 years across three continents and after generation and generation and generation to come to you and your heart, so you might be saved. May we trust in the Lord, who holds the wind and the rain in the palm of his hands, who holds us in the palm of his hands. May we point people to him when we find ourselves in our own storms. And may we trust in him. That's my prayer for you today.